Miranda July, who is the writer, the director, and the star of The Future. Miranda, how are you doing?
I'm great.
First off, I want to discuss the fact that you have two characters in this movie who are in their mid-30s. They are too lazy to leave the couch. They're unable to get their lives together to pursue their careers. When it comes to keeping track of the calendar, they prove negligent. I don't want to give it away. Mm-hmm. And they're crippled so much by their judgment that Sophie is very diffident in the very beginning when she's making these 30 dance videos, and Jason keeps his hand permanently upon Sophie's head. So, as a guy who is in his mid-30s and who works very hard, I was interested in these characters, but I also felt somewhat resentful towards these characters. And I can only imagine in concocting these characters that you, who have worked quite hard, have also may have experienced perhaps some resentment towards your creations. And I was wondering if you could talk about this double-edged sword. What did you do to sort of shake off potential resentment towards people who are really not going anywhere in their lives, at least, you know, for the large majority of the film?
I felt more understanding of them than that. I mean, yeah, I'm really, really productive, maybe even a workaholic, but I feel paralyzed a lot of the time, and I don't, just because I work a lot doesn't mean I feel like always deeply fulfilled, or that I always know what to do next or who I am. And so in a way I took a lot of doubts and fears and put them into my characters. Yeah. And in a way to break out of some of the patterns of, like, you know, using work in a kind of unexamined way. It's embarrassing. It feels kind of awkward to play that role or to give these people time and space. But at the same time, I don't really want to see a movie about these fantastic people doing everything right, you know, and knowing themselves completely. Like, I don't relate to that either.
Yeah. Well, were you trying to depict a current crisis among many mid-30s types, or, you know, I mean, some people could make the comparison that, hey, it absolutely mimics both the Southern California layabout and also the Williamsburg hipster. That's one of the virtues of this film. But on the other hand, I've been seeing a lot more art, especially books, and now increasingly films such as yours, which are really depicting this kind of cadult phenomenon that was written about the New York Magazine. Was this a concern of yours, or a study, any sort of larger sociological reach along these lines to depict this type of feeling?
I never care about the larger sociological reach. I mean, I'm almost entirely concerned with, like, an internal world, you know, sometimes I kind of lament that I have to create characters in order to get inside of them, you know, like I just want to start out already in them. So and then I hope if their insides resonate and are true, that I'll end up making characters that people connect to, whether they love them or hate them, that they'll seem, you know, relevant. And but I never work from the outside in like that, yeah.
How do you jump around from putting your hand into the glove versus, I suppose, creating the glove and stitching it and stitching the sequins and all that? I mean, what's the difference? I mean, do you have to put on two hats? Is it one continuous process?
There's a lot of clothes flying around here, hats and gloves.
Yeah. Well, there's a T-shirt in the movie.
Yeah, and there's a shirt in the movie. You're talking about sort of being inside of the movie and making it?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, acting, writing, directing,
right.
Especially some character that has this particular feeling.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it seemed like if you were going to make a movie that had a lot to do with doubt and fear, like it might not be a bad thing to have a lot of doubt and fear making it. Apparently that I thought that was a good idea because I did have lots of doubts. And when you're in it, you know, that is part of your job, is to feel all those things and to believe in them and to not judge them. And then when you're outside of it, well, it'd be nice if you had some distance, but I don't really. I pretty much am like method directing, which isn't that fun for everyone on the set, especially when it's like a darker movie.
Why not? Why isn't it fun exactly?
Well, like with the first movie was like more hope, you know, more kind of hopeful and innocent in a way. And I think I embodied that when I was making it to some degree. And the second one I also embodied, which meant that I was like fairly haunted the whole time and kind of a little bit wishing I could flee it the same way that my, I mean, very dedicated and yet still having fantasies of like just walking away from the whole thing, the way that my character does. Yeah.
I wanted to actually touch upon something that's really fascinating about this movie. There are a lot of failed artists in this movie. You've got a failed dancer. You've got a failed lyricist with Marshall. You've got his daughter, who is the failed sketch artist. It's fascinating to me that all of these characters feel some need to engage in art, yet this is really their only way of almost identity. The option is to either become a salesman. I mean, you know, you have, you know, the Linkletter character. He says, you know, I sell trees, when in fact that is actually a program that is nonprofit. So it's interesting he has a private relationship with that. But I wanted to ask about this interest in characters who are all failed artists. Is this really, I suppose, the ideal dilemma with which to draw a film? If we can call it a film that depicts sort of the 2010s or the noughts or whatnot?
Well, I don't really see them as failed artists. I think most artists are in some state of crisis a lot of the time. Like it's not that easy, you know? And so I didn't want to have a virtuosic artist that blows our minds. And in fact, I wanted to have the opposite. I wanted like those moments when you don't know what to do with yourself, which we usually look at our phones in those moments now, or or go online. But so I had them turn off the internet to rule that out, and I wanted to go into that space of not knowing, and I think it's a really actually powerful, important space to maintain, particularly for art. It's where new ideas come from, but you have to be able to endure that maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's boring, maybe it's failure. She does, in fact, make a dance at the end.
Yes.
So, yeah.
But only when compelled by the crawling t-shirt, which is interesting. Right. Only when compelled, just as Jason has the moon, it almost takes a supernatural force to get these characters to actually produce art, which I find really fascinating. And it's an interesting dilemma in terms of, well, are we all capable of creating art if we just have that nudge or we just have that talking moon?
Right. Well, I mean, a nudge from your own security blanket is still, I don't think you have to feel like too much of a sellout if you're, I mean, that security blanket t-shirt for me was really like a way to show that she couldn't flee herself. She was haunting herself. And I didn't want to just show her like moping around looking really guilty and sad and like, what have I done? You know, so I took that, all those feelings, you know, and put them in the shirt.
But her head does actually hit the painting of the tree in the background. Uh-huh. And that tree, of course, could hypothetically be, you know, Jason and his selling trees and all
that. Wow.
So I'm not sure if that was an intention on your part. Or...
No, I didn't think of that, but I'm glad you did. Yeah.
Well, talking about this problematic relationship with art and commerce, I wanted to bring up two things. You did for your book this very elaborate dry erase marketing campaign. And in this movie, we see YouTube as a threat to any potential artist over the age of 30. I mean, you know, all these dancing girls, everything is in terms of hits, in terms of are we getting attention and the like. I'm wondering, based off of your own involvement with the internet and what you present in this movie, whether you think the internet is even capable of creating a pure form of art outside of this commerce, outside of this commodification.
I mean, it's a, you know, I agree that the movie doesn't show, like, the great things about the internet, although I think it does admit that, like, we like to be on it. It's fun. And I do, obviously, I'm, like, wrestling with it, you know, actively. Like, I turn it on, I turn it off. Like, I have to turn it off to write. But then again, I love that it allows me to connect with 30,000 people instantly, you know, like, to share a video or whatever. I like the, you know, the do-it-yourself, you know, velocity it has. So... it's not one thing, but I do think for me to not put it in there kind of would make the whole movie exist sort of in a dream world, especially in terms of, you know, artists my age. Yeah.
But because Sophie is also so crippled by the Google Plus or Plus One or the Facebook like button, why that moment against the wall, I mean... We were talking earlier about this idea of art being able to flourish from boredom, which, you know, and I'm wondering to what extent this film is kind of your own introspection on this dilemma of how unique art or distinctly personal art or comes from this almost pure non-internet state. You have to unplug the internet to do it, to find your expression.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's that simple. We'll see. But I did pretty much feel that way while I was making this. I felt like kind of angry almost that I had this new addiction that was so problematic for my work.
Have you tried Google Plus yet? Heaven forbid.
Yeah, no, someone invited me and I deleted it. I was like, oh no.
I assure you it's addictive, unfortunately.
Really?
Another social network obligation in our lives,
We can move on.
Well, going back to the t-shirt, what does it take to get the right t-shirt puppeteer? I noticed that there was. I mean, I'm wondering what the selection process for something like that is.
He does a lot of big stuff, you know, like aliens and different creatures, you know. He was a great puppeteer and very, you know, I think he thought of himself as an actor in the movie playing the part of this shirt, you know?
Yeah.
And rightly so. And we had a lot of conversations about like emotion and, you know, how, like, what was the shirt's state? Like, how sad was it? You know, like if it, and that's, it's all real. I mean, it would move one way and suddenly I'd be like, oh, it's kind of like upbeat, you know, it's kind of like an upbeat, funny, frisky shirt, you know, like that's not right, you know?
Did the design of the t-shirt affect the way that it was puppeteered?
No, a little bit. I mean, it had to be a big enough shirt that I could get into.
Yeah, yeah.
And but I think that helped because, like, for example, my security blanket yellow shirt in real life is much too thin. It would be harder to hide things in it.
Yeah, yeah. So you have a security blanket.
I do,
How many security blanket t-shirts do you
have? Just one until I lose it, which I usually can hold onto it for about a decade.
Oh, so you've had this for 10 years?
Yeah, I've had something always, but different shirts. Sometimes I lose it.
The screaming out the window moment reminded me very much of Howard Beale, you know, in Network, ordering the viewers. I was wondering if that was possibly an intention, that the telephone is really... the medium to best persuade people to express themselves instead of a television.
Right. I love that moment, but I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, it was, I think I had, that's something I say sometimes when I'm talking to someone on the phone in the same city and I don't know where they live. I often say, like, maybe we're neighbors. Maybe you're, you know, like, here, I'll yell and see if you can hear it. And,
wait, so you do just call random people out of the
No, board? No, I don't mean random, but like, you know, if we were doing an interview and we were both in LA.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I'd say it, but I often have that thought, like, what if we're that close? Which is kind of absurd in LA because you're never that close.
Yeah. How often have you yelled out a window?
Never, except in the movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the scenario with Marshall's daughter digging a hole and burying herself into it. This seems to suggest that the next generation of kids are almost dead on arrival. I was wondering how this idea came about.
Well, that the idea of someone burying themselves is, it's not the first time I've used that. I had a performance about a woman who does that, and it's really like a haunting image to me. I don't totally know why, but in this case I used it because I wanted to show that there was a real little girl that did need to be watched, and it wasn't Sophie, it wasn't my character. And for my character to realize that, and you know, that's a real turning point for her. I mean, it's kind of like flicking into, you know, from being a girl to a woman almost in that moment. So it, you know, is a ritual, a sort of self-enforced endurance ritual, you know.
Yeah. But it also forces Sophie to become a mother as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. You offered your voice to both Sophie and Pawpaw. Is this a subtle way of suggesting that Sophie is comparable to a wildcat that needs to be tended, or what of this?
No, I didn't plan on doing the voice for the cat. I never did. I had a long list of actors I wanted to go out to, and you know, we shot the movie, we edited it. I had a temp track of the audio that was my voice that I was going to replace, and I started auditioning actors and realized that I'd lived with that temp track for too long, and I was basically trying to get people to do me at this point, and you know, me as Papa. And in the end, it seemed like, well, if I can find a way to do the voice where it sounds different enough from Sophie, then I think I can get away with it. And it's, you know, I used to always do that in performances, play many different parts, so it wasn't unfamiliar to me.
So it seems to me, would you say that most of the artistic decisions you made in this were related to sticking with your initial intentions, that those very deliberate decisions, such as you doing Pawpaw's voice or you having a specific sense of Pawpaw's voice, guided the movie more than any interventions on set or anything? Yeah.
What do you mean, interventions on set?
Or what I mean to say is, if you had a very clear, deliberate, artistic choice, was that pretty much the MO throughout the movie, or did you
switch?
Well,
I mean, in the case of Papa, I changed. I mean, I had visions of these other great actors, and I let go of those because I thought maybe it was best if I did it. I'm pretty like stick to the script, stick to my original idea. Not because I really want to. I think I would love to improvise more, but it was a 21-day shoot, and that's not really the kind of movie you can like play around with. I mean, you're just lucky to get the thing that you planned on getting, and anything else slips in there accidentally. And
yeah.
And I'm grateful for those accidents, but I'm really just kind of running through the pages. Yeah.
One last question. As a filmmaker, do you feel any obligation to speak to either your generation, which we were talking about earlier, or a specific audience or some group that you've cultivated?
No obligation, but I think each movie you kind of have in your heart sort of like who you hope will love it. And for this movie, I think I thought a lot about like women my age and, you know, what they get to see up there on the screen, and I hoped that I could show something that they hadn't seen before that, you know, would feel familiar to them. Yeah.
So a familiar sense of stasis in this case?
No, just like a very female story. I mean, you know, to see a sex scene that was written, directed, and starring a woman, you know, I mean, that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of different parts. It wasn't one thing, but I thought of them often, yeah.
Well, on that note, thanks so much, Miranda. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you.
Bye, Grace.